Hey, it's Greg. Thanks very much for checking out the Toronto Today podcast for Friday, May the 6th. Well, a lot to do today, and we want to get into the promise. A lot of education promises being made from the Liberal Party and their leader, Stephen Del Duca, to hard cap classes at 20. Will that work? Is that beneficial? Charles Pascal will join us and some of your calls as well, talking about it with us. Erica Eiffel's fantastic on the show today, talking about Roe v. Wade and its leak from the Supreme Court documents, but also the leakage up north to here and the influence it could have in conversations about access and about, well, abortion rights for women in our country and our province specifically. All that and much, much more. It's all coming up next on the Toronto Today podcast, which starts now. When we left the show yesterday, didn't know, because we've had the three of the four leaders were still on the hunt for Doug Ford. We hope to have him on the show next week. But Ontario Liberals certainly left an announcement post-show that had a lot of people talking yesterday morning. This is our chance to react to it. The Ontario Liberals say they will cap class sizes for education. Big issue, education in the province. Of course it is. It has been way before the pandemic. It's going to be even more so now. Some of it's about classroom. The last 2 years have been about classroom safety. It's been about protocols. It's been about when schools should be open and closed. I think we've made numerous mistakes on that front. I don't think there's much doubt about that. I think online learning was a patented disaster for teachers, students, and parents alike. And many of those teachers are parents, and they have their own kids and their students and all. It is a mess. It's been a mess. And I was beside myself. We went back to it for those 2 weeks in January. And I do think we should have gone back to school in late May and June of last spring. I think those things, you won't talk me out of it based on what we know now about COVID and what we knew then even about COVID. I think there were arguments to be made for it. But class size to me was an issue before COVID. We know that. And you might remember going back to your education. I mentioned before 6 o'clock, elementary schools felt packed to me. High schools a little less so. I don't think there's high schools overflowing and brimming because you can select courses at a certain point in time. You've got electives. And it's easier to sort of push kids into a certain direction. And they're going to choose that own direction anyway. So I don't remember high school classes that were, you know, brimming to the gills with like 34 kids, 36 kids. I have no recollection of that. And I was sober my entire way through high school, except for a couple months. So, but elementary school has been a different animal. I think we can agree on that. There's some concurrent on that. And when they say they want to cap class sizes at 20 kids, I do wonder if there's going to be an appetite for that. What's that mean? Well, that means hiring teachers. I suppose that's good news. You're creating jobs. And there's 80,000 Ontario certified teachers right now that say they're not employed by schools. How do we get them back to teaching? Did some retire early because of COVID? Can we get them back? Are there younger teachers that have been certified that haven't found their right situation yet? And maybe they've been afraid to commit. Maybe they've preferred to supply teach. Maybe, again, because of COVID, things have been so uprooted and upturned that they've been more at home and have wanted to be more at home than schools. That's not about safety. That's not about safety at any point in time. We kept hearing all this unsafe September stuff from some of the more activist, militant union members. And September 21 was a very safe place to go back to school. Of course it was. And it wasn't really school. Like, schools being open is an incredibly low bar at the end of the day. It's not near good enough for what we expect as parents with this finite time for kids to go to school. Here's Stephen Del Duca yesterday talking about why he picked the number 20 and why a hard cap would be important.
Again, I want to stress a hard cap of 20 so that students and their teachers can connect with one another, so that students can be taught, but so that the teachers can also reach the students.
Del Duca makes the point that getting 10,000 new teachers, easier said than done, but he thinks his Liberal government can do that.
We're going to hire 10,000 new teachers across the province of Ontario, about 6,500 of those teachers in elementary, about 3,500 in secondary to bring the class size down to 20.
Now, pretty important to give Doug Ford time to respond. And Andrea Horvath, who we had live on the show yesterday, who didn't see this coming because we would have talked about it on the show yesterday, and give her a time to respond. And I'll do that this segment. Let me make the counter argument here, because I think the argument for class size reduction is an important one. And Charles Pascal will join me at 6:45, and we'll let him weigh in. I don't think he's going to be against anything that hires more teachers full time, but I'm going to toss some things at him and some data from overseas, because we're not the only country on the planet, and we're not the only province on the planet that questions itself when it comes to public education. But class size reduction is the most effective, according to a website called publicschoolreview.com. They go deep into data, surveys. They look at the numbers. They look at they have lots of great opinions on education reform and the effectiveness of teacher unions, public school budgets. Here's where they say class size reduction is the most effective. Classes are between 13 and 17 students. Schools with low income and low achieving students are targeted. And we're going to play this game where we say, well, there's inherent bias in the system. And I don't doubt there is among some teachers, but I don't see that's a different story than it being systemic. OK, systemic. We've been using the word systemic for an awful lot of things. And in some cases, it's validated. And in some cases, it's just a word people are throwing out to get your attention. But there also has to be an adequate supply of qualified teachers, an adequate classroom space. I went to a private school in fifth grade, and I thought I had the worst education year I had. Why? There were 11 kids there. 11 kids. I remember this like it was yesterday. 6 boys, 5 girls. I felt it was really unfocused. I felt it didn't feel like a classroom. It felt more like a seminar group. I didn't feel like there was anywhere to hide. I felt vulnerable. I felt shy at first. It was a new school. And I didn't think the smaller class size worked for me. Here's the other thing. If we're going to talk about social dynamics, there are students with big personalities. There are bullies in classrooms as well. And we're not able to negate the bullies anymore because we can't stand up for ourselves on the schoolyard or even in the classroom. I think that matters. I'm sorry. I do. I'm not advocating for random wanton violence. And probably the violence that I went through and maybe perpetrated some of the time in elementary school, everybody who is my age, who's a boy in the 70s, knows exactly what I'm talking about. You got out of line, someone would put you back in. Someone got out of line with you, you'd try and put their manners back in. These things happened. But I worry that big personalities could dominate social dynamics in a small class. I'm not against it. I'm telling you, this isn't a slam dunk easy argument. And then there's the cost. Then there's the cost, which we'll get to in a second. The other thing is, a small group, kind of, to me, in day in, day out, I think it just lacks that energy or that momentum that comes with a larger classroom. A small class can be isolating. A small class can lack diversity. Okay? Think about these things. Children aren't exposed to as broad a range of thoughts and experiences and backgrounds. I don't want a class of 36, but I also think a class of 16 or 17 isn't what school is supposed to be. It's not. It's more challenging to get discussions going in a smaller group. Do we not realize that at the end of the day? There probably is an ideal size, but I think 20 is incredibly ambitious. The premier of the province, Doug Ford, said this about Stephen Del Duca's plan.
Let's remind everyone, under the Liberals, they closed 600 schools. So they won't have to worry about capping anything because they won't have the schools to put the students in. They closed 600 schools. We spent $14 billion in building new schools.
I'd love to hear from teachers and get a sense what they think, and we'll do phones at 8 o'clock on it to some extent on that and talk about, what makes a good teacher. A small class size, I'm sure there's teachers saying, this would absolutely benefit me, but I'm going to tell you again, there can be isolation. There can be vulnerabilities, and maybe it's more time for each teacher to spend with each individual kid and see those vulnerabilities. But I went to, again, private school 1 year. It was not for me. I didn't think I was doing my best learning in a class of 11 compared to a class of 26 or 28. And by the time you get to high school, I guess I've never experienced it with 32 kids there or 34 kids there. And remember, Doug Ford's not wrong. There is a bit of a history there, and teachers had that
tension going for a good chunk of time between themselves and both the Wynn and McGuinty governments. Okay, I know a lot of us like to believe that when something is good, more of it's better. I know that that's true. But the relationship between class size and achievement, when I've looked at it in other countries, it's sort of like that inverted U graph. Like it models the point at which something good, if it's excessive, starts to make a situation worse. And it's good only to a certain point. I think you only can reduce class sizes so much to get the true benefit. There might be a number, a hard number that works. 20, to be honest, to be really fair about this, might be too small a number. Here's what Andrea Horvath said quickly about the situation yesterday.
What I can say is, no matter what Stephen Del Duca says now, he had 15 years to make sure we had smaller class sizes, and the Liberals refused to do it.
Okay, and that perspective is going to be there. I'm not telling you there's no benefits. I'm not telling you that. But it's going to take vast amounts of money to keep class sizes small. It's going to take considerable attention to this. If you believe the smaller the class, the higher the achievement of its students, then where do we stop? I know there's some benefit to more time teacher on a teacher-kid ratio, but it goes up to a certain point. And then every study I looked at yesterday shows there's a bit of a peak out for that. And maybe in moderation, 25 might have been the ideal number. 20, I'm being honest, might be too small, and especially for smaller kids. Very small class sizes with kids under 12. There's some anecdotal evidence that says your learning is going to be more impaired than a bigger classroom. So we saw this about the Ipsos polling I mentioned for Global News. And you and I have had numerous discussions about work from home, 4-day work weeks, all this stuff. Anything, any one stat jump off the page before we sort of run some of them down and give people our thoughts?
1 in 3 Canadians are willing to change their jobs to keep working from home. Are you surprised? How much does that drive you crazy, Greg Brady?
1 in 3 Canadians are willing to lie is my one in three Canadians know how to bluff playing poker. That's my perspective.
No,
on,
maybe
on
they're
that.
Not scared. Maybe they're maybe it has nothing to do with fear. Maybe they're like, hey, I can do this job just as well as at home. And I prefer working from home, even though I'm out at the ball games and the concerts and the everything. I like working from home.
So do you think
maybe
some
that's
of that?
It.
Here's the difference in the demographic. And I think you and I should drill down on this for the audience. 18 to 34, 42% say that if their employer said, come back exclusively and work from the office, 42% of 18 to 34 say no chance. 35 to 54, 29%. 55 and over, I'm surprised at 22%. But I will say the older you get, the more important security is, the more important staying in your career probably is, because there's bills to pay, there's tuition to pay, there's two cars in the driveway, there's a mortgage. And 18 to 34, many of those years, there's less of that. People are, you're more likely to have a sea change in your career at that age and say that. And maybe I'm not 25 anymore. Maybe people are awakening to think maybe the path I was on, the pandemic changed my mind about that particular path. But there's less older people saying that, clearly.
I'm surprised at that stat, that 55 and over are willing to haul ass to the office. I'm really surprised at that.
But why? They're established. They like what they like. They're creatures of routine. They are.
But they're also thinking about retirement, right? So having to start all over at that age and, you know, find another job, that would be when you're in your 60s, you're almost retired. You're planning for that next phase of life. So why would you want to start all over and lose whatever you've had, whatever you've built up at your current company?
So do you think some of that, okay, I'm going to ask you this. Do you think some of that is, let's break this down into fear about COVID, getting into the point where you really like working from home, which is okay, which is an honest conversation to have, and how much of it is just, well, I didn't like what I was doing in the first place, so this gives me an excuse. I cannot believe when I see that younger people are more scared of, oh, I might get COVID-19.
What?
I can't believe that that's true.
This whole poll has nothing to do with fear, so I don't know where.
How do you know that?
Because, well, how do you know that?
I'm assuming.
Because yeah, I know you are. So I don't think it's fear now. I don't think that's the primary factor anymore. I think it's every single job that was told, oh, absolutely not. You cannot work from home. No, I'm sorry. That doesn't work. We need you in the office every day. Then boom, March 14th or March 16th, the pandemic hit and all of a sudden you were working from home and statistics are showing that you're more productive. So these companies have been proven wrong. So employees are saying, well, why not? I'm giving you more of myself and a better version of me working from home than I was coming into the office. So why should we change that?
But if employers say to an employee, we can't have you at your if it's a job like this, I fully agree with you. There's plenty of jobs that you can do just as well in your home environment. And if you don't mind the distractions, if you don't mind kids bursting in the door and loud.
Kids are at school.
No.
Kids are at school.
They come home for, if they live close enough, they come home for lunch for an hour. My elementary school does. And I can't get anything done between 11:45 and 12:45. I can't. I don't want to tell you, I don't want to record an interview then. I don't want to have a big conference call at that point in time.
Oh, so because of you, we need to shut it all down. Now
I'm an exception
like
to the rule because I'm an office
person.
Should
get person. The mandates going then. Now, we should also clarify that this is for white collar jobs. Right? Other jobs have been working through this pandemic incessantly. So this is to even have the option to work from home. This is a white collar issue.
We talked about it earlier in the week. If you think that 0% of the respondents here aren't playing a modest card of,
so
I'm afraid I get COVID and I don't want to come back to the workplace,
sure.
But they're out there doing 28 other things, then it's a bluff. Then
but
it's
that comes with it, Greg. That comes with it. That's just like giving somebody 10 sick days and rolling the dice and thinking, okay, they're not going to be sick for every single one of those 10 sick days, especially when you're younger, right? Come on, tell me you've never called in sick and then gone and done something awesome and fun.
Nope.
Thank you.
Nope. It's never happened. It's never happened.
I'm here. I'm in your 20s. As a teenager, you have. I do not believe you.
I'm working. Well, maybe I was hungover once or twice. But
that's there you go. No, I don't believe that. I don't believe you didn't, whatever job you were, whatever fast food restaurant, whatever server job you had as a teenager, that you didn't call in sick. There's no way. We don't understand responsibility as well as we do as adults when we're that young. Anyways, either
way.
I think
you're trying to prove yourself. I think some people get lazier as they get older and they think, just try. I've been with a company 18 years. Just try and make me work harder. Try and make me come back
maybe
in.
Maybe people
I think when you're 26, you're a go-getter. You're trying to prove. I think you're being reverse ageist here, and I will not tolerate that kind of discrimination against young people. By the way, who's working through a sore throat right now for two straight days? This guy.
Well,
I'm not calling
him
sick.
Who went to a super spreader event?
Hey, listen.
When you go to a concert with 2,600 people, honestly, all of yesterday, I thought I had a sore. Because I saw you the next day we went out for lunch. All of yesterday, I'm like, I have a sore throat. Oh, I have COVID symptoms. But no, I'm feeling great now.
Yeah. Well, I'm not.
But I'm. You go to super spreader events, so you get the sore throat.
I forgot what this was like. I constantly have a sore throat after going to a concert. I probably had 80 of these things in the last 10 years. Because I'll go, I'll stupidly sing, I'll have a couple drinks, I'll sleep. Late and
well, maybe
this
you should
happens.
Work from home. Maybe you should have tried working from home.
I can't go to a concert from home. It's not the same. I gotta be at these super spreader events.
In a job like yours and mine, it's really difficult to do that. But there are so many people out there who can easily work from home. And if they want to work from home, not because of fear, but just because of their lifestyle, the world is changing. This pandemic has proved it. Go for it.
Yeah, I don't think it's changing as much as you think it is, and I don't think employers want it to change as much as
of course they don't.
As they
of
say
course
they do.
Don't.
Yeah.
Look at startups. Honestly, startups know what they're doing.
Well, we should have our own startup. I don't know what the name of it would be or what it would do, but I'm thinking about it. So we're talking earlier about class sizes, whether there's an ideal number, whether there's some benefit here or there. A lot of people messaging me and texting the show talking about portables, and they're right about that. We had a portable at our elementary school in fourth grade, and you feel really disassociated from it. I think maybe that... You're kind of minimizing your benefit if you're moving from portable to portable. I'm hearing from parents this morning that say our school's got 5 portables, Greg, and our kids have been in school in a portable the last 3 years. And whether it's something as simple as getting a fountain drink or going to the bathroom or just feeling just disassociated from the school, is that a benefit? Is that worth getting down to 20 kids as opposed to having 25, 26 kids? And I know there's other classrooms bursting at the seams. What's the ideal number? Let's ask our next guest. We love having him on and talking education with him. He wrote a very well-researched book and a lot of interior stuff from his experience leading from the inside out. He is Charles Pascal. It's great to have you on. Thanks very much for the time, man. How are you?
Yes, I'm terrific. Good to hear your voice, Greg.
Thank you.
Great topic. And as your intro suggests, you know, there's more than meets the eye when you talk about class size. First of all, intuitively, it makes a huge amount of sense that when a teacher can get to know and facilitate the learning, adapt as necessary to individual differences to a fewer number, in and of itself, that's a good thing. And my answer to that is unequivocally maybe. one of the most important things that's been done with class size, and there's tons of research on this, is that the most important deal maker regarding learning is basically the skill set of teachers to be able to adapt to the individual differences of kids, whether it's, and the pandemic has revealed those individual differences before and now during and well after include learning disabilities and LGBTQ and issues of race and learning gaps and things like that. So having fewer number of students where the skill of the those facilitating learning or teachers is also invested in, that's where the goal lies. And, back in the day, there was a premier who did both, like Stephen Del Duca, Premier McGuinty, Dalton McGuinty, promised lower class sizes, and he delivered on that. And at the time, I was a friendly critic.
Yeah,
it says, yeah, but you better do something about the skill set of teachers. And actually, with the help of international education guru Michael Fullan and others, they did both. And that took Ontario to number one in the world regarding English-speaking nations in terms of learning outcomes.
When you hear his announcement yesterday, are you cynical it can be done? 20 is a really low number. Believe it or not, no matter what we think of our good friends in the United States, there's a number of states that have had, Texas has a maximum class size of 22 for K through fourth grade, but then it goes up exponentially. I think when we get, it's not bad practice to go into university lecture halls where you got 200, 300 kids. It's not the worst practice in the world to be in a class of 25, 26 in high school, especially if it's something like a social science. I get it for math and science where you got to drill down, but for creating discussion and having diverse opinions, I love those bigger classes in high school for history and social sciences.
Well, look, again, you raise an important issue regarding, the age and the curriculum and those kinds of things. But again, look, when I first started teaching at the university level, a couple centuries ago at McGill University, I had a class of, I had a lecture hall, filled with about 150 students. But because I believe in individualized instruction, active discussion, active problem solving, basically I would lecture for 10 minutes. I would then ask groups of students to form little buzz groups for 15 minutes to solve problem number 64A1. In the handout, and then come back together and throw out answers and things like that. In other words, effective teaching can arrange for active problem-solving discussion no matter what the class size. So I think, Del Duca is, I think he's right to talk about the fact that class sizes have gotten out of hand. On the other hand, it's by itself is insufficient to get what we're looking for in terms of high quality, lifelong learning on the part of our students.
Charles Pascal's our guest on Toronto Today on 640 Toronto. Would you look and say the younger the age, the smaller the class size should be? It's again, I think for K through four, that feels like, I remember grade four for me, I think out in the country outside of London was 35, 36 kids. And listen, for me, I guess it didn't factor in, Charles, but I think you're isolating something really important. And all the leaders should do that too, is the kids that aren't necessarily heard at home, the kids that have had the toughest time, obviously, with remote learning and schools being closed during the pandemic. Aren't the kids probably like you grew up or I grew up, where it's a two-parent household, you're in a smart environment? I worry those kids get lost in the shuffle in a big class of 36. I didn't feel that way myself. If anything, I went to a smaller class in private school the next year of 11, and I felt very self-conscious about it. I kind of like blending into the big classrooms.
Yeah, the more you and I chat, the more I realize that usually declare me redundant as an expert in education, because you're spot on. I totally agree. And McGuinty, back in the day, he capped class sizes up until grade three. He recognized, and those of us who provided advice suggested, you got to at least get kids off to a self-confident start. You need to identify early on some of those learning disabilities. you need to develop early on a relationship between students, parents, guardians, and classroom teachers. But as you get older, you still want, kids can hide, and there's going to be more and more kids that are carrying over some mental health challenges. And so even with the larger class sizes, as kids get older, you need to create an environment where there's trusting relationships with the larger class sizes in high school and as things progress, so that a teacher can be sensitive to some of the indicators that suggest they got to go deeper with the family and the students. And those trusting relationships are more likely to happen with fewer numbers of students. But again, very talented teachers and principals who guide them can do wonderful things with the larger class sizes as things progress. Again, I have witnessed at all levels of education from first grade right on through colleges and universities, small class sizes where teachers are basically, lecturing, to 15 or 20 kids, when in fact, lecturing to anybody, including me lecturing to you, isn't always a good thing.
I like your lectures. Come on. I like it. I like it.
Only because the interactivity between us seems to work. And we haven't had time to talk about hockey or baseball.
No, we haven't. We got to do it next time. I had a grade 11 math teacher. The only year I did really well in math, Mr. Chidley would come in and he looked like Vincent Price, Charles. And he'd go to the, if we were talking in class, he'd go right to the, he'd grab a meter stick and we'd be like, if we don't be quiet, he's going to bang it on his desk. Like, I don't want to, I know we can't bring that back, but I was a big fan of Mr. Chidley. And if you could break him and make him smile, that gruff exterior, you really learn from him. I had to earn that 71, Charles, in grade 11 math, okay? I'm no rocket scientist.
Good for you. I can see the stern look with those corn-rimmed glasses.
That's what it was, yeah. And he had the Vincent Price goatee going. He could have been on the Michael Jackson song at the end of the day. I got to leave it there. Let's chat a couple more times before June 2nd. I know this. You care so much about our province education this election, so let's do this a little more often before the election.
All right, you take good care, Greg.
Speaking of normal, we're out for dinner last night, and I get a straw in my drink. And remember the plastic straw debate. This is a big one before COVID. Should we stop? I made it a point to say, kids, stop ordering straws. They're like, but we like straws. I'm like, but, it could end up a turtle's nostril, or it could end up in the sea. And no, we've got to stop doing that. So we got to make some changes here. Make reusable straws. I had a paper straw brought to me last night. I forgot to ask for a straw not to come. And then COVID hit us and hit us hard. Okay. And guess what we've been using? A lot of single-use PPE. We were using gloves. Can't preserve rubber. Those gloves that we were buying in the boxes. Face shields. We had wipes. They go in the garbage. You can't flush them down the toilet even. You can't recycle them. And yes, the mask. But this is not your usual mask segment. People are going to continue to wear them, and I encourage choice. You know that. I say wear a mask if you feel like it. I've had to do it on a plane. I've got to do it in a walk-in clinic. Probably do it when I go back to the doctor's office. I wear it when I come into the workplace here. Okay, but what do we do with them when we are done? How many times have you walked through a grocery store parking lot constantly and you see a reusable a non-reusable mask and it's just lying on the pavement? And at times, yes, I can't remember a time when I didn't do that. You don't walk past it, you pick it up and you deposit it in the garbage. But it's causing huge problems. If I give you some of these numbers, and our next guest will do that, you will be beside yourself. So the goal is everyone stop wearing masks. Nobody would say that. That'd be totally irresponsible. But we got to figure out a better solution than what we're doing now with them. Joining us to discuss is an environmental writer out in Portland, Oregon, Susan Johnson. And Suzanne, I think it's one of those scenarios where we talk about this and we talk about the usefulness of the mask. And there have been points in time when it was really useful for all of us, either practically or psychologically. It still is psychological for a lot of people. But the uniqueness of the environmental damage is something we haven't talked about much.
The thing that is unique about the masks, no one really thought about what they were made out of, right? And they seem like cotton. They seem like something natural, but they're not. They're polyester, and they're woven in a way that makes them breathable. And because they're breathable, there are these little strands that will break down in water. And once these loosely woven fibers hit water, they get to be a little soupy and they start breaking down into the microplastics, which don't ever really go away, but they look a lot like algae, right? And so they get eaten by some poor little critter that mistakes them for something delicious.
Yeah.
And then it just builds up. And out of all the personal protective wear, you know, there was also gloves. A lot of people wore gloves, but masks were the thing that everybody did. And so between those little fibers and the other part of it that is pretty bad environmentally for animals are those little loops that go around your ears, because they get snagged on bird legs and any little creature that they come across.
It's not a statement, is it, Suzanne, on do masks work, when should we wear them, who should wear? Like, those are big arguments even still, but the numbers are the numbers, and the environmental damage is the environmental damage. So what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly. You can't say don't wear a mask because it's bad for the environment, because people have to stay healthy. And that's not at all the point I tried to make in the story, but rather just being more conscientious about what happens to the masks after we dispose of them. And you're completely right that there are so many things that really, we had a lot of progress on getting rid of plastic straws and single-use plastic bottles. And then COVID hit and suddenly we're surrounded by basically personal protective wear that you wear it once and then people throw it away. And the thing that we can do is make sure they don't end up anywhere near water, because that's when things get really impactful. And that's when the microplastics are shed off of those breathable gauzy layers that make the mask. And then they start going through the whole food chain. It's easy to think, oh, one little mask, it doesn't, what's one mask? I'm not going to chase that down through the wind and get that back. And yet they add up. There's just, you know, the studies have estimated 129 billion per month during 2020. So by now that number is down, but they really, you know, those little masks add up to a lot. And so it's one little thing that everybody can do to keep plastics out of the environment.
And yeah, there's going to be garbage. We all feel that, like, we're cleaning out our garage at our house right now. And we're like, what can we do? We don't want to get rid of like 60%.
Oh, yeah.
Of it. We're like, what can we donate? What could somebody use again? And then there's the inevitable, right? You grit your teeth, you cringe, and you're like, no one's going to take this. So it ends up being junk. But you make the distinction that our junk, we're going to need landfill sites. Garbage has to go somewhere. But when it goes into the ocean, it's got this reverberation that's awful for everybody. It's awful for fish. It's awful for eventually, you know, all of us. It's awful for beaches. It's terrible. And when we talk about, you quoted the figure, 5,000 tons of floating ocean trash, and that's just face masks. There's a lot of other environmental degradation to the oceans as it is. It's just, you're in awe and yet you're horrified at the same time at that number.
Yeah, the numbers are, yeah, I can't even wrap my head around the numbers. It's hard to imagine what is a billion face masks? What does that look like? And World Wildlife estimated that just 1% of masks are blowing away into the waters. And so even that amount adding up to a significant contribution to ocean plastic makes you realize how many we're going through. And it has to be that way. And, you know, one thing I live in Oregon, and we do see people putting masks on in the summer because we have a lot of wildfire smoke and the air quality goes down. So it's going to be around beyond COVID. And it's just one more thing that we can, you know, make that little conscious effort to change. And that makes it a little better anyway for the rest of the world.
So last thing for you, there's no real way, and because some people have strongly suggested when Omicron came, the strong suggestion was there, upgrade your mask to an N95. So unlike our household used a lot of washable cloth masks, and we felt like, you know, we're not generating a lot of waste. Sometimes we had to go somewhere, visit somebody in a home, and then they give us a surgical mask, and we're like, well, there's nothing we can do about this. We have to take it. But when we went cloth upgrade to N95s and KN95s, we understood why that some were suggesting that, but that just made it worse, because they're going to get used, what, a couple days at the most, and then they go into the trash.
Yeah, yeah. And the, you know, the quality of the masks and what people wear for what purpose, I think they just have to follow their medical advice and go with that, because that is critical. You gotta stay healthy, and you gotta keep the people around you healthy. And sometimes that just does involve creating some waste, but being conscientious about how you manage that is one thing that everybody can do. And I kind of compared it to pre-pandemic. Everybody was worried about straws, and there was the photo that went viral about the poor turtle that had the straw up its nose. And you know, we kind of lost sight of all those things during the pandemic, and understandably so, because there were a lot of other things to be worried about. But I do hope that we are getting back to the point that we can kind of look at all the single-use plastics and just make an effort to manage them properly and reduce what we can, whether for if that individually for you means that you can wear a reusable mask, mm-hmm. or you can get a reusable mug, or you can just skip the straw. There's little ways that all add up in the same way that each one of these little masks adds up when they hit the ocean.
That's Suzanne Johnson joining us from Oregon. And I'll tell you, like, it's exactly everything we talked about. If you wear a mask, what's the thing to do? The single-use masks, make sure you secure them in a trash bin. It's not a perfect solution, but we can't have them in the oceans. We can't have that. I think a lot about the environment, a ton about the environment. I almost say, who doesn't? The issue is, what should we spend? What are the policies? Again, you know, people like me you're on the wrong side of history if you were calling people like me, a tree hugger 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We've got to keep plastics out of the ocean, or you're getting it with your fish, okay? You get a side serving of plastic with your salmon or your tuna or your halibut or whatever, or your cod. So we got to keep moving and keep disposable face masks. Okay, fine. If some people are going to wear them, okay. The goal, by the way, with getting vaccinated is to stop wearing disposable face masks, but I digress. Get them in the garbage, okay? Get them in the garbage. It's not a perfect solution, but they can end up in our water supply. They can't. Very pleased to welcome on our next guest. We love having her on our show. We love our conversation. She's the co-host of the Bad and Bitchy podcast, columnist at the Hill Times. She is Erica Eiffel. And fellow Earth, Wind, and Fire fan. I see you shouting out, Let's Groove. Exactly. What a great track.
Oh, my God. You saw me respond to Richard Marx?
I've tweeted at Richard Marx before, and he's responded. It's a weird. One of those 1 a.m. things.
He has a fire Twitter account.
Yeah, he's okay? Good. He's good.
Oh, my gosh. Who knew that Right Here Waiting had so much personality?
You're looking at it the wrong way. Satisfied and Don't Mean Nothing. Those are jams. Come on. I can do without the ballads. I don't need your sappiness, Richard. I got enough syrup and saccharin in my life. I need some bangers on a Friday morning, Erica. Come on.
True.
But Let's Groove is that. All right. I mean, you lived in the States. I lived in the States. You see the news, the news leak on Roe v. Wade on Monday. I didn't know that we'd be talking about it as much, but I'm actually relieved that we are having real, honest conversations. And I think in Canada, you tell me if I'm nuts, I think we got to have more conversations about access. I don't see the law changing, but let's talk about access and making sure women know what the access is in their respective provinces.
Well, it depends on the province, and there's very little access across the country. I think people, when they talk about access, especially bring up New Brunswick, which mm-hmm. doesn't have one sort of clinic that or hospital that offers an abortion. And that what that means is that women then need to start thinking about going outside of the province, and that adds extra costs, especially if you already have children, right? Because you're talking about childcare, you're talking about the cost of actually going, the procedure, maybe stay overnight, I don't know. And so what I'm seeing is this really is an attack on sort of undesirable women, quote unquote, which are basically, BIPOC women and poor women and rural women and women who are systemically disenfranchised anyway. Because if you have means, you can get an abortion.
Yeah.
It's inconvenient, but you can get one. And so much of our society in this day and age depends on your means, and it depends on your class. And the policies that we have depend on those.
And I think we've woken up the last 2 years about a lot of stuff to do with our healthcare. We used to puff out our chests and pat ourselves on the back, look at us, yay, with our socialized healthcare. And when we realize those with means don't see how broken the system is, and then when the people that have means actually see, and everyone else is like, we've been trying to tell you this for 3 decades, how limited access is, how limited information is. We got doctors that need to actually also go back to work. The rest of us have. And I see, when I see Erica in PEI, a lot of listeners were shocked when I laid this out yesterday. They offer in-province abortions up until 12 weeks and 6 days pregnant. After that, you have to go out of province. And I'm thinking, right, Florida says 15 weeks. And we think, I'm no fan of Ron DeSantis, but we think this guy is a monster. And we've got a province saying, you got to make that call within 12 weeks, regardless of medical circumstances, or you got to, you know, you got to leave PEI to do it. And I, if you needed a knee surgery, you wouldn't want to get on a train or drive and stay overnight somewhere. Think about this decision, the biggest decision you'd make as a prospective mother and as a woman.
Yeah. So that PEI quote is exactly it. We do like to feel smug. We have no access. And I also want to point out that the repudiation or the reversal of Roe v. Wade, the potential reversal, I'm not sure how far it's gone down the pipe, but it started with restrictive access. It started with shortening the window of as to when you can have an abortion. It always starts with that. It never starts with, we're going to ban this outright. It's the, we're going to move the goalposts further and further down the line that make it even more and more difficult for you. And I also want to point out that there's no scientific evidence for like heartbeat bills and stuff like that in terms of what they're trying to achieve. So there's no scientific evidence for it. What is the real purpose?
Do you worry about the politics? I know people say, well, this candidate is, Sam Oosterhoff gets mentioned a lot in Ontario. Sam Oosterhoff's never going to influence the party platform. They know that's political suicide. There's people that are always going to be, as I would call it, anti-choice as opposed to pro-life. But I'm not seeing the full picture here, because there might have been people with Roe v. Wade that say, don't worry, the Supreme Court won't touch it. The Republicans know. Should I be more worried about the access in Canada or Ontario than I am?
I'm more worried about the political trends that we're seeing in both the U.S. and Canada. And that's towards something that's far more conservative and far more right. And the Christian right and the far right are bedfellows. They always have been. Mm-hmm. And so what I see, if I zoom out of this, I see an attack on trans kids. I see attack on LGBTQ rights. I see attack on abortion. I see attack on the Voting Rights Act, right? And if you take those things together, what we're talking about is tearing down a lot of the civil liberties that have been fought for over the last 60 years. And that is frightening, because what are we left with? There's a reason we got that in the first place. And I see a coordinated sort of movement towards this over that 49th parallel.
Tell us about, let's talk about your podcast interviews this week. Fascinating, right? You talked to Michelle Rempel Garner. So I love that you got, you give people a voice that you may not be aligned with 1,000,000% politically. And you talked as well to the Ontario Liberal candidate for Brampton East. The Liberals, they've got 7 seats. They've got a lot of work to do here. I think both those episodes will be interesting.
Yes. So Michelle Rempel Garner. Okay. This is her second appearance on the podcast, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So I will sit down and talk to people in good faith. The problem is that you don't get a lot of people talking to you in good faith. I've seen Michelle make space. She's made space for me. And she's, I always like outspoken women who will stand up and say, you know what, I screwed up and I've contributed to X, Y, and Z. I mean, I'm like, you can't even get people to admit their own responsibilities. You know what I mean? So I'm, and maybe I'm maturing. I don't know.
Oh, no, not you. Yeah, of course you have. Hey,
yeah.
You're at where you are with politicians like I am at with the pandemic. Like, tell me what you got wrong. Oh, nothing, yeah. Nothing over 27 months. Then we can't have an honest and accountable conversation anymore.
Exactly. And there's too much politicking and positioning going on to have a good faith conversation with some people. I would encourage people to listen to that interview because it really does dig down to the state of politics and where we are right now. And, you know, what we're doing and the algorithms that go into it and so on and so forth. Now, the second interview, so we just did that yesterday.
Yeah.
Yes, Brampton East. I really loved her. I did. I thought she was clear. I thought she knew how to talk to people. Like when I was on CBC this week, and they asked me about the election, I told them that the NDP and the Liberals have a tendency to be too cerebral. And Doug Ford is really good at addressing those issues,
yeah,
those that require user fees and that you have to pay up front, right? Because if you look, that's what he addresses. Mm. I mean, it doesn't do anything. It's all, you know, smoke and mirrors. But the point is that way people feel like they're being heard, right? But with this candidate, she seemed like, this is somebody who grew up in the community. Jeanette, she grew up in the community, and she, you could tell that she loves the community.
I can't wait. I'm eager to give them both a listen. I'll let you know thoughts and go to the Bad and Bitchy podcast website. Hashtag Stay Bitchy, which it's Friday afternoon. I plan to yell out that out of my car at several drivers on the way to London.
Got her domain
today.
Back.
So oh, good.
Bitchy.com.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
I got a blast. Have a great week. I know you're coming to Toronto soon. We'll talk about that next visit, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Erica Eiffel joining us. She writes for the Hill Times, the Bad and Bitchy podcast as well.
Thanks for listening to Toronto Today. Have yourself a great weekend. Monday, now our next live show on the 9th. We'll obviously have two Leafs Lightning games from Florida in the books and set up where that particular series is at and lots more on the Ontario election campaign trail. Thank you so much for listening. It means so much that you're as loyal to the show as we want to be to you as an audience. Check us out, by the way, to listen live at 640toronto.com or on the Radio Player Canada app and search Toronto Today. Thanks again. Have a great weekend.